state donations can come with tax benefits for you and lasting value for KPFK. It's easy to start. Just visit kpfk.org/real estate or call 1-844-277-4663 and learn how your gift of property can make a meaningful difference.
Hello, and you are listening to Eco Justice Radio on KPFK Los Angeles, a project of SoCal 350 Climate Action. Our show presents environmental and climate stories from a social justice frame, featuring voices not necessarily heard on mainstream media. Welcome, I'm Jack Eit. On today's show, the real Thanksgiving, truth, myths, and the Wampanoag legacy. Host Carrie Kim will be interviewing Paula Peters, journalist, native scholar, and citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe. Paula Peters is an active citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe in Massachusetts. For more than a decade, she worked as a journalist for the Cape Cod Times and is now co-owner of Smoke Signals, that's SYGNALS, a native-owned and operated creative production agency. As an independent scholar and writer of Native and particularly Wampanoag history, she produced the traveling exhibit Our Story, 400 Years of Wampanoag History and the Wampum Belt Project, documenting the art and tradition of wampum in the contemporary Wampanoag community. Linda Coombs of the Aquinna Wampanoag Tribe on the first Thanksgiving, How Can We Tell a Better Story? Produced by Smoke Signals and part of Native Knowledge 400.
My name is Linda Jeffers Coombs, Aquinna Wampanoag Tribe, Mashpee resident. The myth of Thanksgiving, you know, it's very damaging. It's damaging to Native people because it's not true, and other people believe it. And when we go to explain the actual history or the events that happened during that time period in the early 17th century when the harvest event that became known as the first Thanksgiving happened, when we go to explain about that, we get challenged, we get pushback. So it's very frustrating, it can be angering, it's insulting. And I also think it's damaging for non-Native people because they're believing a lie.
Aloha, this is Carrie Kim. Listeners, today we are honored to have Paula Peters joining us, citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe, to talk about the historical and cultural legacy and story of the Wampanoag people. We intend to also unravel some of the common misperceptions and false narrative around Thanksgiving and the harvest of 1621 involving Native peoples and the first colonizers, the Pilgrims. We thank the Tongva ancestors for their enduring legacy, presence, and leadership as our show comes to you from the ancestral homelands of the Tongva and all of their relatives. And we encourage listeners to align with and act on behalf of the many Native nations across Turtle Island in solidarity with local Indigenous peoples and do our best to ensure their continued cultural heritage and lifeways remain for future generations to come. The Wampanoag have lived in southeastern Massachusetts for more than 12,000 years. They are the tribe first encountered by Mayflower pilgrims when they landed in Provincetown Harbor and explored the eastern coast of Cape Cod, and when they continued on to Patuxet, also known as Plymouth, to establish Plymouth Colony. In 2020, America commemorated, those air quotes, commemorated the 400th anniversary of the Mayflower voyage and the founding of Plymouth Colony, a story that cannot be told without the perspective of the Indigenous people who were here as that ship arrived and who still remain. The rock is a 7,000-pound silent witness to the vitality of the Indigenous lives that thrived there for as many as 12,000 years before colonization. It also serves as a monument to forgetting them. Engraved on the face of the stone in large point Times New Roman font is 1620. It is a testimony to the length to which historical memory is encouraged to go to avoid knowing what came before it. Native human beings were kidnapped and sold into slavery. Disease devastated numerous tribes, and injustice robbed them of their sovereignty. We now are turning to Paula Peters to speak to us about the authentic history of the Wampanoag people. And we are so grateful to have you on the show, Paula.
Hey, thank you for inviting me.
Is there a particular way you would like to open the show?
I think you did a fantastic job.
This is your words. This is your words.
Yeah, I recognize some of the quotes, but you know what? You pulled it off beautifully, setting us up for the discussion. And you know, at this time of year, being a contemporary Wampanoag person, we get called upon a lot to speak to this issue and to try to unravel this history, correct the stereotypes and misconceptions, and really unearth the backstory to colonization, which really gets lost in the hallmark holiday that has become Thanksgiving. I'm used to talking about this, particularly at this time of year, and appreciate that you've invited me here too.
Well, we're so grateful, as you've said. I mean, a lot of people don't know the true history. I mean, it's what they're taught in schools, and it is that romantic, kind of patriotic version of the story. And many people, it's a hard history to actually go back to. And it's not that I don't know some of these aspects of the story, but it's always something more egregious and disturbing than we can imagine. And it's hard for people to actually willingly go there, because it's very disturbing and uncomfortable, and you have to acknowledge it. I wonder if you could please first share which were the tribes that inhabited the region, and in this region of Cape Cod Bay, Massachusetts, what is also known as Massachusetts, Rhode Island.
Sure. Well, directly here in southeastern Massachusetts is the ancestral homeland, my people, the Wampanoag people. To the south of us were the Narragansett. Mm-hmm. There was also the Mohegan, the Mohawk. Inland tribes were the Abenaki and the Nipmuc. And to the north, the Passamaquoddy and Penobscot. There were thriving indigenous nations up and down the coast, but became known as New England. And yeah, we had quite a network of tribes and communication between tribes and diplomacy between tribes, bringing the English and the European influence really brought kind of a shock to the region. I think that people largely did not know what to expect and were probably pretty surprised at the way that people were treated.
Right. I mean, it was more trusting, would you say? I mean, initially?
Yeah, it seems as if, yes, there was a lot of trust that was initially, that was the way. I mean, that initially they offered some trade, which was a great novelty to the tribes. Right. Because they didn't have items made of glass or metal or cloth even. And so when these ships came and offered to do trading with the tribes here, that was a great novelty. And there was a lot of curiosity about it. So they would go to the ships but they learned pretty quickly to be wary and cautious, because there became many incidences of being captured and being taken away back to Europe. And it wasn't just for slavery. That was part of it. There was a lucrative slave trade. But there was the curiosity back in England. They want to know, what were these people like? They want to know about their language and their lifestyles, because they were planning settlements and, well, trade, of course, was lucrative. And they were planning to come and settle here. So it was in their best interest to learn about the people that were here.
Right. Would you say it was more opportunistic in that sense? Or do you think it was some authentic interest as well?
No, it was pretty opportunistic. They were using these people, if they would survive, they used these people as guides. Sometimes they would be able to come back as guides and maybe be able to escape and come home. oftentimes as much, they would get there and quickly get sick and die because indigenous peoples here did not have exposure to the kinds of sicknesses that were rampant in England and in Europe. Those people, the English and the Europeans, had built up immunity to all of their plethora of illnesses. But as soon as one of our people was exposed to it, they would become deathly ill, as we know in the case of the Great Dying, which impacted all the coast of New England from Maine to the tip of Cape Cod in 1616. There was an illness that spread very, very quickly. Actually, they think that it may have been a series of illnesses.
Simultaneously happening.
That happened one after another, and it weakened the people greatly. There are some estimates that those coastal villages that were documented by explorers like John Smith and Champlain and Cabot had been decreased by as much as 90%.
Wow, that's so amazing.
It was a devastating, devastating plague. So prior to the Mayflower even arriving, you had all of this interaction, some of it being just trading and getting goods back and forth. The English did find great value in beaver skins and fox skins and animal skins, that sort of thing. They also enjoyed getting Indian tobacco, was very popular to trade. And they also came for sassafras because they believed that in England, syphilis was just, I mean, it was awful. It infested people, and that's why people wore powdered wigs. But they thought that sassafras tea was something that would cure
remedy.
That it's not true, but it didn't stop them from wanting to come over and to get as much sassafras as they could.
Well, I wonder if you could speak more about what the lifeways were of the Wampanoag at that time and the other tribes living in these coastal areas. What was the lifestyle? If you could kind of paint a picture for people.
You know, the people were very agricultural. They had farms and they grew crops. They would typically come from inland villages to the coast in the growing season. And also while they were living coastally would be fishing, and also they hunted for whale. And so fishing and whaling and planting crops happened throughout the planting season. They planted corn, beans, and squash. They also foraged for roots and berries and, you know, many different kinds of herbs that were used medicinally. Sassafras, that was very, very, and remains very popular. I'm actually sitting here right now with a glass.
Having sassafras tea.
Yeah. So it remains something that's very popular with us and obviously became popular with people who make root beer.
I wonder if you could speak about also what were the spiritual beliefs or the cosmological beliefs, because, you know, that's so often that this belief that the indigenous peoples had no kind of societal organization, no sort of leadership, they're painted like these quote unquote heathens or savages with no sort of spiritual life. And that's patently untrue. But I'm wondering if you could share that.
And we have to be really careful when we speak about our spirituality, because, you know, it is something that we protect and hold close to our,
understand,
our traditions and sort of, yeah, I almost want to read you something.
Sure, please. We welcome that. Yeah.
There's a place in my writings where I actually do address that.
Okay. Paula, please share.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there was a piece that I ended up writing for. It's actually an introduction to the 400th anniversary of the William Bradford Journal of Plymouth Plantation. Mm-hmm. And they asked me to write an introduction from the Indigenous perspective. And I answer that question in here. So I'm just going to read that to you.
Thank you.
Had the English bothered to look for it, Native spirituality was everywhere. It centered on the tributes of the earth and the wonder of other worlds, honoring the sun, the moon, and four directions, as well as animals and birds. No chapel was necessary, since ceremonies were held wherever and as often as the occasion called for, without an assigned place or day of the week. It required only a circle, where each one was individually unique, while still part of the whole. Birds and animals had spiritual significance, like the crow that delivered the first seed of corn from the southwest. There were also many Thanksgiving opportunities to honor the Creator's gifts, like the celebration welcoming the strawberry as the first fruit of the season. Drumming and singing and dancing had spiritual significance, as did adornments including beads of shells and copper pendants, and symbolically painted faces and tattoos, embroidered clothing and feather headdresses. These are all customs and traditions still honored by the descendants of those people today. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it's so important to realize that, because we see that again and again. You know, I don't know if you also could share anything about Wamsutta's, that suppressed speech from that would have been shared in 1970.
Sure. So that we're kind of jumping around there, but
yeah,
that's okay. I actually, maybe I'll tell you a little bit about how I became involved with the commemorative events of the 400th anniversary of the arrival of the Mayflower. There was a committee that was assembled to commemorate that. Mm-hmm. And they were very sincere about wanting to be inclusive of the Wampanoag story. We weren't initially very trusting of that idea, because in 1970, when there was a 350th anniversary of the Mayflower arrival to be celebrated, they asked for a Native person to come and speak at their celebratory feast dinner. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they had requested that Frank James, who was an Aquinnah Wampanoag elder, come and speak to them. And Frank did, he did write some remarks, which they saw. And when they saw his remarks, they were not happy, very unhappy with those remarks. Right. They said, no, we really like you to change this, because it wasn't that Frank had written anything that was untrue, but they liked the story of the pilgrims and the Wampanoags having a Thanksgiving feast together, you know, that whole
harmonious feast. Yeah.
And they didn't want to hear about what had really happened. And so Frank declined to alter his speech in any way. He declined to be censored.
Right.
And instead took his speech to the top of Coles Hill, which, if you are familiar with Plymouth, it's the hill that is overlooking the waterfront. It overlooks Plymouth Rock. It overlooks the Mayflower 2 ship, which is one of the biggest tourist attractions on the East Coast.
Uh-huh.
And gathered there with some 250 or more people who came, many from the American Indian Movement, many Native people from throughout New England, as well as supporters who came. And he gave his speech that day verbatim. And from that day forward, each year on Thanksgiving Day, Native people gather at Coles Hill, and it is recognized as a national day of mourning, where Native people honor the sacrifices of our ancestors. So there was that history behind it. And when I was being asked to somehow participate in a similar commemoration, but 50 years later, of course, there were doubts abounding about whether or not I would be treated fairly and whether or not I could be heard. And my initial response to them was, well, yeah, I'll participate, but here's the terms. And the terms involve the development, an exhibit, which was launched actually in 2014, because for the Wampanoag, 400 years doesn't begin in 2020, in 1620, right. Begin for us in 1614, more appropriately, which was when the time that Squanto was actually kidnapped and taken away. And a lot, that started the ball rolling on a lot of things. I mean, Squanto is the only one of those men kidnapped in 1614 who eventually comes back and ends up playing a pivotal role in Plymouth Colony. And so that kidnapping event, the great dying, and then those things that happened afterward. Those were all things that it was going to be important for us to document in our exhibit, in our storytelling, in our events. I kind of proposed that, and I thought that they were going to say, well, and I mean, I didn't think that they would agree to it, but they did agree to it, and they actually funded it. And it became an opportunity for us to really get up on an international platform and retell the story in the Indigenous voice. So it turned out to be a very good opportunity for us, for Wampanoag people to balance the story that is told. So I was grateful for that.
Paula, we're going to take a break right here and talk a little bit more about that 400-year exhibition that you created. And just be right back, listeners.
Hey, listeners, quick break here. We hope that you're enjoying Eco Justice Radio. I'm on KPFK Los Angeles. Stay connected by subscribing to Eco Justice Radio on all major podcast apps and visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, to check out previous shows and guests and get connected with us on social media. Today, you are listening to The Real Thanksgiving, Truth, Myths, and the Wampanoag Legacy, with host Kerry Kim and guest Paula Peters, journalist, native scholar, citizen of the Mashpee Wampanoag Tribe of Massachusetts. Following is the story of Squanto, the tragic truth behind the Wampanoag, Squanto, and the Thanksgiving story from the Smithsonian Channel.
The familiar Thanksgiving story implies that pilgrims were the first contact Wampanoags had with Europeans, but many came before them.
European fishermen, traders, had been visiting the coast of New England for at least 50 years, maybe even as many as 100 years or so.
The people they met were taller than Europeans and lived in dwellings called wetus that were warmer and drier than a house made of wood.
We had Englishmen, Dutch, French, traders, fishermen, and enslavers here.
Transatlantic slave traders captured and kidnapped Native Americans.
Those were some of the early diplomats representing European nations amongst Native people, and as a result, there was a lot of really negative interactions.
7 years before the pilgrims set foot in North America, a Wampanoag called Tisquantum was kidnapped and taken to London, where he was enslaved. History will remember him as Squanto.
He's taken in 1614, away from his homeland, which was thriving.
Improbably, he gets free, learns English, and makes his way back in 1619. Just to discover tragedy had struck.
What happened here between 1616 and 1619 was the deadliest thing that ever happened to our people.
A lethal pandemic took upwards of 90% of the Wampanoag population. They call it the Great Dying. It came from Europe, where bathing was considered unhealthy, even dangerous. Louis XIV of France is said to have taken only 3 baths in his lifetime. Though no one knew it at the time, microbes carried by unwashed visitors brought disease to North America.
Imagine what Squanto was thinking coming home and seeing all his people, at least most were wiped out from that plague. That's going to affect somebody, right?
This tragedy and this abandoned village will come to play an important part in the story of Thanksgiving and in the lives of people thousands of miles away.
Listeners, we are back with Paula Peters, the Mashpee Wampanoag peoples, and also of her production agency, Smoke Signals. So, Paula, if you could speak a little bit more about what it was like to produce that 400-year exhibition that details the Wampanoag history. It's our story, 400 years of Wampanoag history. And it was unprecedented, right, for its time.
Yeah.
Scale and scope.
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. And, you know, we were Smoke Signals was really happy to take the reins and engage in that project and pull together. It was actually a series of exhibits, which we launched in 2014, as that was the 400th anniversary of the kidnapping of 20 men from the village of Patuxet by a Captain Thomas Hunt. Mm-hmm. Hunt was part of fleet that had been commissioned by John Smith, who was more famous for his exploration of Jamestown and then ultimately New England. But he mapped the region and he had made some contacts with tribes up and down New England coast. He was really trying to establish trade partners and potential settlements. Mm-hmm. And when he left behind Thomas Hunt, who was a little bit more nefarious. He was supposed to be trading with the people of Patuxet and then to follow behind John Smith and go back to England. But instead, he lured aboard his ship 20 men from Patuxet and 7 men from Nauset. And once they got them on board, they somehow captured them and brought them below decks and sailed them across to Malaga in Spain, mm-hmm. where they were sold, or some of them were sold into slavery. Some of them were, the sale was interfered by some friars, some monks in mm-hmm. Spain. And then it's not 100% clear how they were dealt with mm-hmm. after that. But it's this major event.
Yeah, that you never hear about.
And it's funny that when people are learning about the mythical version of Plymouth Colony and the first Thanksgiving, they think, oh, well, isn't that wonderful that Squanto could speak English? And they don't ask themselves the key question, how did he learn to speak English? Well, he mm-hmm. learned because he was captured.
And he was forced, right, to speak.
Yes, and he was captured and he lived in the company of a gentleman in England for a time and then was able to convince some people to bring him back so that he could come back as a guide. Mm-hmm. But by the time Squanto returns, the next chapter of our story occurs. So our first piece of the Our Story exhibit is this great learning piece about Squanto. And so then we move each year between 2014 and 2020, we rolled out a new part of the exhibit.
Of the story. Got it. Paula, we thank you so much for the dedication to your people. Could you share also how listeners could be in contact with you? What are some of the links that they should go to?
Yeah, we do have a website and it's Smoke Signals is spelled with a Y. So I always have to remind folks that it's smokesyginals.com. And certainly go to our website, certainly go visit us on Facebook.
And also our history, 400 years of Wampanoag history. Can they go to that from Smoke Signals or they need to just look for that?
I think that's still on the Plymouth 400 website. So yeah, we might have some examples of that on our page, but to really find most of that material, you want to go to the Plymouth site.
Okay. We'll be sure to include those links so listeners can dive on all of this and truly educate themselves and understand what's actually happened and where to go, how to go forward. So Paula, thank you so much for joining us on the show today. I mean, these are hard things to acknowledge, but we need to in order to do our best to ensure the cultural legacies and the ancestral lifeways of Indigenous peoples continue. And it's important for our times.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
Hey, listeners, please tune in to part 2 of this interview, or to explore our other shows, visit our website, ecojusticeradio.org, and subscribe to our podcast. This has been Eco Justice Radio and our show, The Real Thanksgiving, Truth, Myths, and the Wampanoag Legacy. Thank you to our guest, Paula Peters, and thank you to our listeners for joining us. Please connect with us on social media at Eco Justice Radio, SoCal 350, and Wilder Utopia. If you like what you've heard and you want others to be informed, subscribe and share the episodes. You've been listening to Eco Justice Radio, a project of SoCal 350, executive producer myself, Jack Eit, co-host Carrie Kim, and engineer, and original music by Blake Quake Beats. And until next time, remember, the power is yours.
Donating your car or boat is an excellent way to help KPFK stay alive and on the air. All you have to do is call 877-KPFK-AUTO. That's 877-KPFK-AUTO. And we will take care of everything. Seriously, it's that simple.
What's going on, family? From the Bay to L.A., my name is Kat Brooks. My show, Law & Disorder, is now on KPFK. Cutting-edge interviews with organizers, culture workers, newsmakers, and freedom fighters. The weekly state terror